I'm Hugo Disler from Farming Secrets. We have the pleasure, but actually a privilege, to have two experts on the line. We have Graham Hand and we have Lynn Kelston. So, Graham, would you like to introduce yourself very briefly, because we have heard you last time. So can we hear from you, Graham?
Yeah. G'day, Hugo. How's it going? I'm
good, thanks.
Just a quick introduction. My name's Graham Hand. We live in southwest Victoria, run a few cattle, and work for Stiper Native Grasses, as well as sort of as a private consultant and trainer in managing holistically.
Fantastic. We want to cover this Australian native grass, because we'll cover that hopefully in this call, because we do know that Australian native grasses deliver more to the soil than probably any other plants in the world, for that matter. They just do extraordinary delivery, as we've seen on some people's farms. Now, we've also got online Lynn Kelston. Lynn, would you like to give an introductory of who you are and your green cocky business?
Thanks, Hugo. Yep, my name's Lynn. My partner and I have a smaller farm in central Victoria, just outside of Kyneton, and we're farming predominantly Angus beef cattle. We've had this property for approximately 3 years now, but I have been involved in farming for 15 years. My professional background before stepping into farming on a larger scale is as a nurse and midwife, but I've been ensconced in microbiology in the soil of late, and to the point that I've commenced a small business called the Green Cocky, which looks at assisting farmers to enhance the biology in their soil for better productivity.
Lynn, when we looked at your introductory, first of all, you did a introductory in the, well, in your little studio outcome classroom. And then we went out in the paddock. When you did your introductory, I really tuned into when you said the word disconnect, because it's quite clear to me now that farmers are relying on this and that, and they're, in other words, relying on all sorts of sources, resources, and the word disconnect really resonated with me. So is it okay for you to start this call with your interpretation of disconnect?
Yeah, thanks, Hugo. I think that that's something that I found was really prominent in my mind when I started looking at how to manage farmland from my own resources. And it was, I noticed a real lack of deep knowledge about what was happening on my own land. And I guess I extrapolated that back to my nursing background and midwifery background, where what are naturally normal processes, being birth and death, were very poorly understood, and there was a cultural divide about owning that knowledge about those processes and seeing that in farming to some extent as well, in that a lot of knowledge was held by external people, not necessarily the landholders. And a lot of decisions were being made from external inputs without there being a true understanding of the way farming and soil and the interaction with stock actually works. So from that point of view, I guess it was a real disconnect that there was a lot of reliance on somebody outside your own industry directing what happens on your farm. And for me, remedying that was about knowledge, gaining knowledge, and certainly the more I've gained, the more ownership I have of the decisions I make about the farming processes on our farm. So I think, you know, I guess I can only encourage people to regain that knowledge and therefore gain the control over their farm and have some self-determination about the decisions that are made for their farm. And it's that knowledge that enables you to have the input to those decisions rather than being directed per se.
Graham, would you like to make a comment on that? And Lynn, you're most welcome to keep talking on that subject. So Graham, what would you like to say?
Oh, yeah, I agree with Lynn. There's a disconnect between sort of what the land actually needs and what we do and how we manage it. So, and I think it's reinforced by sort of We're currently practicing agriculture with a lot of bare ground and not much decomposition and not much litter in the system. So, yeah, I agree with Lynn. There is sort of like once you start to see that, it's not easy to fix, but it's sort of the only game in town, I've been saying. So,
I think, too, that partly it, there's a reluctance of farmers to embrace scientific knowledge. You know, when I speak with farmers, they tend to say, look, I'm not scientifically orientated. You know, when you start talking agronomy and you look at soil tests and chemistry particularly, some farmers are very au fait with it, but a lot of them say, no, I leave that to the agronomist because they understand cation exchange or, you know, the different ratios that are required. So they've tended to hand that knowledge over or that decision-making process over to people who they perceive as experts. But when we actually come back to look at different ways of managing moving away from a chemical orientation of farming, I think that there's a whole gamut of skills that farmers actually already have within their toolkit. But it's a matter of encouraging them to access those and to have confidence about making those decisions, and that's where increasing their knowledge base on those things that they already have a base understanding of. And, you know, a lot of farmers have been in it for a long time. You know, there's generations of farmers, and if they talk to their grandparents, you know, the farming that they did in their time would be quite different to, say, the instructed farming that's conducted now. I think that there's an opportunity at the moment to bridge that gap between the old knowledge and what's new knowledge, because often it is a matter of combining the two to get the best outcome.
Yeah, good, great. Graham, you've also got some slides up, so anytime you want to start talking about your slides, please refer to them. This is not going to be orchestrated by me. It's really going to have a natural flow between yourself and Lynn. So, Graham, do you want to start talking about your slides or want to talk about anything that you feel is important? Because we did, this part of the call is more about going out in the paddock and, you know, making these observations that the group did.
What I've really been doing a lot of work on and actually working with him, which has been fantastic, is with David Tongwei, who came up with the landscape function sort of idea and an analysis and what drives sort of stability and water infiltration and nutrient cycling. So he's sort of studied that in depth, and I've spoken about it before, but I think it's really the basis of sort of how we start to turn the land around and shift it to a low-risk, low-cost sort of business agriculture, rather than, I see a lot of it, the advice as being high risk and high cost. So talking a fair bit about landscape function and just what does that look like on the land. I like to show people lots of photos of decomposing litter, just so that they get that idea that in a grassland, the intertussock space has got to be filled with litter that's decomposing at the soil surface, so that CSIRO research shows that if you want that nutrient cycling, you've got to have perennial grasses and decomposing litter to get you to hold your nutrients in place and also to get them plant available. So rather than providing them in a plant available form, it's that decomposition process that actually drives that plant availability. So we focus a lot on that sort of with a lot of the grassland work. There's clear science on that. What I've been trying to get people to do is sort of is really say, well, yeah, we need to know how to monitor for this, but we also need to make it happen. So I get people to set up sort of small trial areas that they actually manage in sort of what I've been calling like a simulated planned grazing. I spoke at a fire conference over in Adelaide a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about prescribed burning and how they did their monitoring beforehand. Even on the day, they do lots of planning. On the day that they were going to light the fire, they did a pre-assessment. So they monitored before and after. They had a goal that they were monitoring towards on what they were trying to achieve, and then they monitored afterwards to see if they got it. So because it was a burning conference, which I'm not a big fan of burning, but I started calling what I do as prescribed grazing, because it contains all those components as well. And I just sort of, to transfer that and to get people to trial it in an easy, low-cost way, we just do small areas that they start to use recovery and the animals to sort of initiate that decomposition and, you know, like almost composting of the litter on the soil surface and sort of get them sort of to explore those things, you know, in a low-cost, low-risk way so that they can decide whether it might suit their business or not. But a lot of the time, I think we need to do the trial first and then see whether it works and then sort of work out, well, how can I get this into my business in a way that only improves the cash flow, the land, and reduces the workload. So will I keep going, Hugo or Lynn? Did you want to say anything?
Can I just add in a comment there, looking at from a biological perspective, why that combination of perennial grasses and ground cover works so well. And to have the two systems of an active functional biology system in the soil with a prescribed grazing technique, as Graham's outlining, it's understanding that biology needs a living plant. So your perennial grass or your perennial species is vital to have that active biology. And when you've got that active biology, your rate of decomposition will be so much higher, so therefore your plant cycling or your nutrient cycling is much more rapid, so you get your return onto your growth system much quicker. But it, as well as maintaining that ground cover, which is a vital part because you've then got water retention within your soil. So the three elements in combination make for an outstanding functional system.
Yeah, it just, I can't understand why it's just not promoted, Lynn. I just go, wow. So the one of the things that we find as well is that there's a lot of focus on other plants. And people are always sort of chasing some sort of silver bullet plant, whereas what we do is just focus on you need a large diversity of perennial grasses. So we're going as an intermediate target of 30 perennial grass species in your paddocks. And the research is pretty clear on that you actually get an effect of that combination of plants actually ends up every time there's sort of drier conditions or wetter conditions or cooler or warmer, something is growing and something's actually biologically active. So that you're actually starting to sort of lift the resilience and the stability of the whole grassland up to a new level. And we find that once we get up to around that 30 species that so many other issues disappear. So, early on when you get that ground cover between the sort of the current perennial grasses, you'll start to not get any of the forb or weed problems that you would have. And then you go up, you get more decomposition, you get more species, and then you come up again to another level. So it's quite interesting to see that sort of that session kick in and go up like that.
Yeah, I would have to agree totally that diversity is a major key in robustness of the system, because allowing for any gamut of environmental conditions that a farmer will face over any given time period, if you've got something that can operate in any given environmental condition, then you've always got some functioning part. So it's about having the diversity that allows for, even if it's only one species to prosper in that environmental condition, it then will carry the system through till the environmental conditions are more conducive to greater expanse of other species. But that diversity is key, and it's the same for the biology as well, that you have to have enough effective biology for any given circumstance, and it's about fostering that diversity to accommodate those environmental fluctuations.
I had people here this morning, Lynn. They came for a farm walker. They're full-time farmers, a father and son, and it was pretty interesting because we've had a little bit of rain, but we haven't had sort of any of this rain that's sort of going through sort of from central through to eastern Victoria. So we're still pretty dry, but we've got so much litter, and we'd already initiated growth. And one of the farmers' comments was, oh, you could go for 6 weeks without any rain and this will keep growing, which I thought was pretty good because typically around southwest Victoria, we're having to wait for that really big rain in one big hit, where we've had sort of like little dribs and drabs, a couple of mils here, a couple of mils there. So it's sort of like, you know, the growth starts earlier, which is, I liked your comment about sort of some of the farming practices that used to be about, because, you know, everyone used to March calve down here because the growth would start pretty well in March as soon as the hot summer disappeared. And that's what we're finding happens more and more. But I think, and as you said, combining with the modern, that we need to be really conscious that sort of a lot of those, how do you do that at stocking rates that also maintain your profitability? So that's what I'm talking about with the planned grazing. How can we actually give plants sufficient recovery to replace their root reserves, to build litter in the base of the plant that will then become the litter between the plants, and allow any plants that are now germinating to establish and become, like fully recovered and replace their root reserves before they get grazed. So I'm thinking that, that's what's so important about what we're doing with sort of a focus on agriculture that regenerates pastures and the landscape. So.
I was at a conference in Bendigo just recently, and there was an interesting talk done about measuring subsoil moisture levels. And when you're talking about variable rainfall and, you know, changing from what traditionally has happened, being able to get that moisture, even though it comes in smaller portions, or, you know, it might only come in one big portion, being able to get that down into a reserve level in your subsoils is vitally important. And part of that is not having a compacted soil, and also maintaining that litter cover on the surface. And I think that the combination of good biology activity in the soil with the planned grazing makes that system much more effective at getting that moisture down into the subsoil, and hence, you know, giving you a longer grow period.
I just want to expand on that to one point. Sorry, Graeme, is that we went to talk just recently by a Swords for Life talk, and this particular farmer said that in New South Wales 70% of the rainfall is regarded as useless because it's under 15 mils, and he said on his property he has value out of those small amounts. And I think Lynn and Graeme, you might like to comment on that because it's quite important.
I think it's one of the key points that I put it up on my wall in my studio where I write notes all over the wall, is that you have to be responsible for every drop of water that falls onto your land. And if you can ensure that that's entering into the soil rather than being evaporated off because there's no ground cover, or running off and creating a risk for erosion, or where it just can't penetrate the soil because it's too hardly compacted, then you're not being responsible for that amount of water that falls, regardless of whether it's a small amount or a large amount. It's our role as farmers to actually ensure that what resources we receive, we can make the best use of.
I was going to be unkind, but I won't be unkind. There's some recent research come out of the Evergreys project up at Orange in New South Wales, and it really just confirms what we're saying, that they divided the landscape up into low production, medium production, and high production zones. And what they found was that the highest below production zones, and it only grew, even though it had the highest COLP of 55, it only grew 4.6 tonnes. And the high production zone only had a COLP of half of that, 21, and it grew 9.9 tonnes. Of dry matter per annum. So, like, you know, half the phosphorus and twice the growth, but it was about the plant available water.
it actually had much more plant available water in the high production zone, which was a consequence of better water infiltration and better water holding capacity, which is all biological things. This is one of my hobby horses, is that we keep looking for engineering and chemical fixes for biological problems. So, you know, we're just sort of saying, well, let's switch over and do some low-cost trials on addressing that biological problem and see how we go.
I think the key point that you've said there is that you don't have to make a transition in a large scale. Sometimes that gently approach, where you try something to see what the response is, without compromising the returns on your farm as a total, but allowing yourself to try something new and to step away from what maybe is your comfort zone, but not at a compromise to yourself. So being brave enough to have a go, I think, is a really important thing. And especially, I mean, there is that element of people looking over the fence to see what are you doing. But I guess the science is there fairly substantially now to support, you know, doing things differently. So I think it's important that farmers be brave enough to try it.
Yeah, I agree, Lynn. And I was a bit unkind about this research because they described it as a game changer. I said, well, CSIRO have been saying this for 30 years. How come now you're saying it's a game changer? Why haven't you been looking at these things? And I think it's just a way of approaching agriculture from that sort of, it's an engineering problem or it's a chemical problem or whatever, and then missing the point that it's basically about life. Agriculture's about life and trying to maximise that. When I spoke at that fire conference, I was saying, you know, the problem we have is that oxidation's exceeding photosynthesis. So, you know, oxidation, burning fossil fuels, burning biomass, grasslands and forests, as well as losing carbon from the soil. So they're really big issues. And, you know, how do we address that? So, you know, like, so we need to start thinking about, well, how do we increase photosynthesis? And it's about biological things. It's the diversity of plants. It's litter on the ground. It's perenniality is just a crucial. So there's been some pretty good work done in the USA with cover cropping and things with annuals and using mixtures and diversity is king sort of type idea. But with the annuals, they're starting to find that they're not getting the they've sort of plateaued. Their soils improved to a long level, and now they're realising that they've probably got to go heading more towards some cropping practices that actually include either more perennials on a longer phase out of the cropping, but also trialling more pasture cropping, you know, colocynthia sort of idea.
Yeah,
that's
and
where the Australians
good...
are well ahead. Keep talking.
there is good research from various nations now that, you know, preserving the ground cover on your soil is so beneficial, and, you know, the fella in Dakota, I can't think of his name right now. Gay Brown, that's correct.
Yeah.
You know, he's been doing cover cropping for a considerable amount of time, and his returns are significant. And colocynthia is mimicking that in Australia here. And I think, you know, the cereal croppers have come a long way with their adopting of no-till technologies and controlled traffic. So they're certainly making advances, but there's still ground that they can cover that they maybe haven't embraced fully yet. But I think it will be it'll be a process that will be adopted because it will be required to be adopted.
Yeah, I think so.
Graeme, do you want to talk about your... I know you've got some slides. Do you want to talk about your slides at this stage, or how do you want to run this business?
Oh, well, I think sort of where I felt that we were up to, Hugo, was that sort of we've talked about sort of how you do things, what's required, but then some of it's about how to do. I think most of your members are really, they're already committed to a path of going down regenerative agriculture, but the big gap is the research and sort of the knowledge on how to do things. So I've been saying to people, I see this as a grazing as a science, not as an art. So Do you know, like, we could try and clearly define what the outcome is that we're managing towards. So we have increasing landscape function, and I'll make sure that link for people if they want it's on the notes that go out, but also perennial grass diversity with a target of 30. And then we just talk about sort of that that leaf emergence rates of perennials to grow the litter. So you've actually got to go past the optimum in the plant. The optimum for the whole farm is actually going past the optimum for individual plant species, which sort of people struggle with a bit. It's actually not getting the plant when it's at its highest protein. It's actually getting it when it's at its best protein for the animals. So when it's dropped enough so that it gives them good dung scores, but it also allows the animal to push the litter back onto the ground to promote that landscape function. So being able to recognise that, and I've developed a perennial grass recovery scale with what you see at each stage of that recovery and how much litter. So I think that's a really good thing to do, to sort of get some of those materials and look at them, to know what decomposing litter looks like. And I've tried to put that in the slides with all different environments ranging from Cobar to Geelong. So, there's one up there on the top right that's actually from southern Tasmania. So the two top ones are from central west New South Wales, and it's that brown decomposing compost-looking material, which is the grass leaf litter. I'm really strong on sort of making sure that you check this and see if you can make it happen on your land. We've tried it on lots of properties, and we haven't found one that it doesn't work. It's just harder in some environments because they tend to be a little bit less productive. And then, what are the benefits of doing this sort of management? We had DPI staff come out here a couple of weeks ago, and they just couldn't believe that there wasn't any thistles and things like that, because we had a very tough summer the year before, and most people have been spraying, like having full-time programs on thistles, and some of the neighbours are saying, oh, we're leaving those thistles because we just can't keep on top of them and stuff like that, whereas we didn't have any even with a tough year. So how to take a paddock that's, you know, like predominantly weeds, you know, less than 10% perennial grass, even down to 0% perennial grass, and managing it back into a perennial mixture of a pasture grassland. So we talk a lot about how to do that, you know, that sort of making sure that you've got the litter on the ground at the autumn break, so that you know, when those forbs and that germinate, they actually are smothered by the litter, so there is no space for them. Lots of perennial base areas, so you've got big perennial grasses, and they're maintaining control of all the nutrients in the soil rather than having things leaking away into other plants. You know, we've done this with sort of from, you know, the annual grass weeds to cape weed to thistles to Patterson's curse to Bathurst burr to cat heads to any of those sort of like those low successional forby type things. And then how to regenerate the grasses from there, recover the landscape at a profit. I've been saying there's lots of ways of doing this. Which ones can you do with your abilities and your property that you can do at a profit? Because a lot of the people I work with actually need to be increasing their profit rather than decreasing their profit. Some of the other weeds that we've had success with are serrated tussock and African lovegrass, which are quite, you know, they're problem plants. It's actually sort of the current management's creating the conditions for them. How do you change that? How do you get enough information to do a trial and know what to do? With the slides that I sort of had prepared, I'd put in about how to design a trial site. So, you know, the photo that I'd had in there was, 1,000 weathers in sort of a quarter of an acre, and sort of not bearing it off, just pushing everything onto the soil surface. So, a pasture or grasslands ready to be grazed when it contains a combination of green leaves for the animals and dry leaves for the soil. So you've got soil food and animal food, and you know, make sure you partition that properly so you know, you get most of the green into the animals and most of the dry leaves onto the soil surface and taking them off beforehand. You know, and then sort of trying to make it so that that's sort of the best that it possibly can. Some of the other things that are key skills is that you must be able to get animal performance on this older grass. And also, if you're controlling how much the animals eat, where they eat, you've got to be pretty good at monitoring. So you have to develop some different monitoring skills, and that's why I've been using the gut fill and dung scores to sort of so that people have got really early warning at the moment. You know, we're only just coming out of the dry summer feed, which is sort of, you know, it's been hard to keep sort of gut fill on that dry feed with the cows. So, you know, we're sort of, you know, like as that changes now, they'll get more and more green and less dry, sort of, so that happens pretty quick. And, you know, they can go to loose dung scores and, you know, you've got to react to what you see in front of you. I was trying to think, Lynn, what the term is in medicine. You know, is it treat symptomatically or is that an expression?
Well, in medicine, they generally do tend to treat symptomatically because they can't get to them proactively to prevent the symptoms arising. But it's always better to treat proactively if you can. But, yeah, more often than not, medicine does treat symptoms rather than causes.
Yeah, I'm saying don't throw out that idea as well, though, because, you know, if their dung scores have gone down and they're struggling a bit, you do have to get in there and start thinking, is this a serious problem? Am I going to get, animal health problems? What am I going to do? So how do you get the dung scores back to a sort of more up to that score 3 rather than down at the 1s and 2s? So, which can be a real problem if you haven't had some green growth through smaller rainfalls during, you know, before you get that big rainfall. So we really focus in on those changes of seasons and just make sure that we've got it covered, because I find that big summer rains or change of season is actually when you can really do some damage to the animal health. So don't be frightened to come in and treat symptomatically was what I've been saying if it's not working. Yeah, like we'll have in the notes sort of the gut fill scores sort of, you know, just on that left-hand side. And, you know, the dung scores, when it's a nice pie for cows and when it's a nice group of soft pellets sort of like in a cone shape for sheep, sort of the ideal. So not a paste, not little bullets and little shot. And, so that was about all I had, Hugo. Was that okay? Was there something I missed there?
Graeme, what you covered is just so much that I can't see how anyone can really understand all that. They really need a chap like you, well, need you on their farm to go through it all, because you just covered so much so quickly that... Yeah, we just haven't got time to go through it all. It probably takes 2 days to go through all this. So, Graeme, I can't answer that question because you just covered so much.
Yeah. One of the things I've been doing, Hugo, is when people say, oh, can you come and have a look, I say to them, you know, put in your trial sites first, put in a couple, and I'll come in 6 months because, yeah, we'll then know, is there a viable soil seed bank of perennial grasses? Did the land move? We'll have something to talk about. Otherwise, you're sort of talking about the current practices, and there's a myriad of reasons why, you know, everyone and anyone's doing their current practices. So I just say, look, let's put in the trial. Let's make it a really valuable visit when I come, because then we can talk about, well, what did the trial show? Did it go this way? Did it go that way? And then we can work out what to do next from there. So it becomes very valuable. So, yeah, I probably did cover a fair bit. I was sort of conscious of the time. I hope that was okay for people.
Well, it is outstanding, Graeme, what you and Lynn have got to say. What we're going to do now is open the line. So if people want to ask questions, we just want you to actually just butt in, because that is the best way, and we will be accommodating. So the lines are open, and when you call us, we'd love you to keep the background noise in your own places down to, well, just got to keep them right down, because the line is open. And so if you've got a question, please ask it. If you haven't got a question, I will be asking Graham a question or two, or Lynn a question or two. So if you want to come on the line, just please say who you are.
Can I just continue with a bit of a conversation regarding weeds and the growth of weeds? I've been doing some work on a property on the side of Mount Macedon that was severely infested with bracken. And we took the farmer who's managing that property and I took a biological approach to looking at why that bracken was so dominant on that property. And that began with looking at what biology was supporting that plant, because each plant will dictate in the soil what it's looking for or what it wants. And predominantly the root system of the bracken was dominated by bacteria. There's four groups of soil life, I guess, that we look for. But around the root system of this bracken, there was predominantly just bacteria. So we took the approach that if the bacteria was supporting the growth of that plant, then let's disturb that bacterial dominance in that root zone. So I actually made up a fungal inoculant, and it was a combined approach of slashing the bracken repeatedly, but also applying fungal teas onto that soil that was affected by the bracken, and therefore disturbing that bacterial dominance in the root zone. And putting the fungal matter into the soil and retesting it to make sure that the uptake of that biology was successful, so seeing that the fungal numbers in the root zone increased, it actually stunted the re-emergence of the bracken after it was slashed. So there's been two applications of a fungal inoculant that's gone onto this bracken, and it's been slashed three times. We deliberately left a section that we didn't put fungal inoculant on to see whether it was the slashing or whether it was the combination of the two that had the effect. But in a measured area of about a metre square, initially there were 15 mature bracken plants in that space. And after slashing and the inoculation, the re-emergence was back to five bracken plants in that metre square. In the area that was just slashed, there was 11 bracken plants that re-emerged. And then after a repeated slashing and the second inoculant, there's only been three bracken plants that have re-emerged in that section. And the regrowth of the other species in that area, you would normally expect that there would be a large emergence of broadleaf into an area that's had exposure. But what we found was that plantain was the predominant species that came back, as well as a re-emergence of the clovers. So from the farmer's perspective, there was a riparian zone along there, a waterway that we wanted to protect. So we haven't had to use any chemicals. There's been no tillage disturbance to the soil. There's been no re-sowing costs to reinstate beneficial pastures. So we've made a significant impact on the bracken infestation. We've fostered desirable plant species. There's been no loss of time for grazing or production time for that paddock. And it's been a fairly good outcome just from a biological perspective for two applications, and there's been enhanced benefits to the soil in general, in that the compaction zone that was about 15 centimetres down is now virtually non-existent. So that's from a biological perspective, looking at weed management. And when you tie that back to what Graham's talking about with prescribed grazing, a lot of those systems, it's about increasing the biology and the function of the biology in the soil. We've probably been able to enhance that by actually putting the desired biology there rather than waiting for it to appear under the circumstances. So you can actually enhance and proliferate the desired effects that you want through looking at biology. And you generally find, from a biological perspective, that weeds will dominate in an area that's compacted, that has poor water infiltration and has a high nitrogen content. And bacteria are one of the highest nitrogen components on the planet. So where you've got a lot of bacteria, you'll have a lot of nitrogen, but that has to be cycled to be available to plants for productive growth.
Now, got anyone to ask a question at this stage? Okay. Well, the question I'm going to ask you, Graham, and I want you to really bring this out, because there's a thing about the decomposition. The litter has to be in a certain, I'm going to just go back to muting the listeners because I've got a bit of background noise there. Graham, you talk about decomposition, and it's not just as simple as having, dry matter on the ground. And can you explain the process of decomposition, please, Graham?
Yeah. So, thanks, Hugo. The key is to get the litter covered, the ground 100%, so that you've got it sort of even solid concentration, so you can't see the soil at all. I get very disappointed when I go to stubble bash days and they go, oh, they've got so much litter, and I go, oh, I can't even see any. So the raindrops can't see the soil, or the sunlight can't see the soil. So if they can't, then the soil's protected, and you protect the life and you hold the moisture. Then to actually activate decomposition, you've got to press it onto the soil surface. So it needs to be pressed onto. Now, when we're grazing, we use the muzzles and the feet of the animal to press it on to the soil surface, which then allows the life in the soil to get hold of it. You don't press it into. I used to say sort of like so that it can get into the soil, and people, when I went there, they'd almost pushed it into the soil. I'm saying just onto the soil surface, so firmly onto the soil surface. The only place that I've seen this actively go that's similar to Australia in terms of how seasonal it was and having hot periods and dry periods and all that was in the States, where in the winter they actually got several feet of snow, and the weight of that snow pushed it onto the soil surface, so it was very healthy and decomposing without having to use animals. Where that doesn't happen, you've got to, one of the ways to do it, I was going to say you've got to use animals, one of the ways to do it is to use animals. I always have people that want me to say, well, I haven't got animals, I can't do animals, what am I going to do? And I go, well, I have got no time for sort of using mulches and slashes and things like that. But if you are going to use one, then you have to have a heavy roller behind the mulch or slasher to push it onto the soil surface, or a sheep's foot roller or something. So once it's onto that soil surface, it's got to be left. You can't keep coming back and trampling and trampling and trampling, because it actually sort of like almost breaks it up too quickly. And then the soil's protected. Then it can actually start to hold some moisture. Then it can actively start decomposition from there. So it's a composting process. So it's the closest words that I've been able to find for people is the whole landscape needs to be sheep composting in place. So healthy bush, healthy grasslands, healthy that, all rely on having the ground covered and a decomposing layer between the material, the litter, and the soil surface. And when you dig down through it, when it's going well, you can't scrape it and find the soil surface. And I always knock on something for people. If it's going well, it'll be a transition layer where you go from raw litter, which will be yellow, yellow browny colour, to then getting more brown, to then eventually you dig down through it until you get some more. So it's like an open, porous, transitional layer, rather than this is the air, this is the soil. You won't find that clear differentiation. And if you're not getting that, then you're not getting to that decomposition, Hugo.
Great. No, it's a great explanation, Graham. Really appreciate it. I'm going to open the lines once again, so people, please feel free to get on, start talking to us. In the meantime, while I'm waiting, But look, don't wait for a gap, just start talking. The interesting thing is that when you look at what, not our farmers, but farmers in general, the amount of money they spend on weedicides, pasture replacement, stock health remedies, and fodder conservation, and their own health, because if they read what's written on the labels, it's quite often on the label of the particular product to use as a health warning. So that's also very important that farmers have got to protect their health when they're using different products. Now, versus all those costs, which with Lynn, you covered quite a few of those costs when you talked about the bracken, the value of having, and those costs quite often just go on year after year and increase, having an expert on the farm like yourself, Lynn, or Graeme is absolutely worth it. So, Graeme, would you like to have a bit of a chat about your role as, you know, what services you offer when it comes to going on farm?
I was just going to start. We write a newsletter for Stiper that comes out every 6 months, and the old ones are available on the Stiper website. But in the latest one, we've just written looking at sort of in southwest Victoria, how could you redesign a sheep enterprise to make it lower risk, more profitable? And, you know, overwhelmingly, the pasture costs and the feeding costs and the animal health costs are just going through the roof in southwest Victoria. And we know from our work around sort of high rainfall areas in New South Wales and Tasmania and things that it doesn't have to be that way. So we can massively reduce the pasture costs and the feeding costs and the animal health costs. And, because at the moment they're comprising over 40% of the stocking rate is in just paying for those costs. So if you can take those out, reduce them down to sort of like, you know, a couple of percent of the stocking rate, you can make the same amount of money but with less animals. And that, Mark Gardner in the article goes, it brings up a problem in that those extra animals are worth a fair bit of money now, and, you know, it frees up capital for the business. Lowers risk. You know, the biggest reason grazing enterprises fail is because they run out of grass. If you're running at a lower stocking rate and managing really well and making as much money, you'll actually keep more money over a decade. So the sort of work we do is we do a 6-day course where we actually teach people about the different parts of managing holistically. So we do a 2-day introduction and understanding of the whole ecology of farming, as well as the business. The next one's about sort of how do you redesign those enterprises. And the third block of 2 days is about sort of training and planned grazing with a real focus on sort of that detailed monitoring and skills. So we do that. We do on-farm visits. We do a lot of work through Stiper on sort of, you know, regenerating native grasslands and managing native grasslands, because how do you handle the biomass? If you're not going to burn, what do you do? And we can do that on private land. We do that with managing with the grazing animals. So it's that sort of, I have a real grassland, perennial grassland business and family business design. That's really where I like working. How do we make those businesses more successful and more stable so the people are enjoying what they're doing? And, we're getting a lot of data that comes back that once people start regenerating their grasslands and enjoying it and seeing it, that they start actively promoting agriculture to their children and to others. And I reckon that's a great measure of success. Are people actively promoting agriculture, or are they still using that, you know, leaving the farm to one of the kids is like child abuse? So we're getting people that saying, you know, it's a privilege now to leave the farm and the kids are loving it. So, yeah, so that's the sort of area and what sort of lights our fire, Hugo.
Oh, great. No, it's great. Now, Lynn, what services do you offer?
Well, to date, I've been working predominantly with farmers who choose to step away from chemical farming, and that in itself is often an economically driven decision because the input costs are just becoming excessive, and particularly in light of when superphosphate was extremely expensive, they had to look at an alternative. So I guess my focus is on utilising what essentially is a free workforce in the soil, but fine-tuning that so that it works at its maximum, and that's ensuring that you've got a balanced ecological system within the soil. So I can come and do an analysis of your soil, a basic microscope assay. Certainly there's more advanced techniques than what I can offer, but I can certainly look at, from a baseline perspective, what your functional biology in the soil is, and then can look at fine-tuning that with inoculant additives to balance the biology, to get the nutrient cycling occurring more effectively in your soil without a chemical input. So it's about utilising what's already present in your farm. I also hope to expand into more of an educational role. I've done some work with some primary schools, particularly who have a Stephanie Alexander garden program, just educating kids about the life that's in the soil and how vitally important it is that we actually foster that and look after it. And part of that fostering comes with understanding it. So I guess I have a huge focus on awareness and education. But, yeah, I guess analysis of soil and preparation and application of inoculants to fine-tune that biology for maximum outcomes.
Great. I'm going to bring in a subject now, which was a question that was asked in this meeting with farmers up in Wodonga. And the question was asked to the panel was, or not so much to the panel, to one particular farmer who's using natural sort of methods. And he's using all the fertilizers from his own property, and he's been doing it for something like 12 or much longer years. And the question was, aren't you robbing the soil? Aren't you sort of taking away, I think he's trying to refer to the balance sheet system, like what you export you have to replace. And the farmer said, no, well, actually I'm improving my soil. The soil's and the nutrients actually increasing in the soil, and the indication is that my pastures are better and my animals are in much better condition. And he said there's no at this stage there's no sign of things crashing. And he also said if things did crash, which is not likely, then I'm so far ahead financially that I can cope with this. So Graham and Lynn, would you like to make a comment on what I just said?
Yeah, will I go, Lynn?
Yeah, please do.
I get this a lot, aren't we mining? And it's an interesting question, because down in southwest Victoria, they have this idea that if you don't keep putting on the superphosphate, that you'll get into a debt trap that you'll never be able to get out of. And I think it's really clever marketing, and there's no evidence to support it, but that's what they keep saying. But what the way I answer that question, Hugo, is I said, as long as we continue to monitor, assume that we're wrong, you know, like... it's one of the things I got from Alan Savory when I was trained by Alan Savory was, you know, when we're managing things as complex as the land, we've got to anticipate that more than likely we've got things not quite right, that we're probably wrong. So what are we going to monitor? Well, you could monitor the phosphorus availability, or you could monitor the pasture performance. And then I say, if you find out that you're actually starting to deplete that phosphorus, and we've got people that have been working over 20 years now, and they still haven't reduced their phosphorus level. If anything, their phosphorus level's gone up. That if then you would take action and you would get in there and do something about it. The thing is, I say, if you're going to add phosphorus, you need to add it in a form that promotes biological decay or that decomposition of the litter, because it's actually sort of, it's not a bad thing necessarily to put on phosphorus. I don't think it's necessary, but it's not necessarily. But if you put it on in a form that stops biological decay or decomposition, then it really stuffs up the whole system. So I don't think that there's any evidence that we're mining. And when I'm being really cheeky, I do this thing. I would have thought mining was digging stuff up, putting it in trucks and throwing it out on the paddocks. I would have thought that was mining. But it is an issue, and people worry about it, and we've been told about it. But the key is not, you can't just stop putting on the phosphorus and not change the practices. You've actually got to increase that nutrient cycling by increasing the decomposition of the litter, the landscape function. You can't just stop and not do other things. So, because the system's basically wired that it's got to cycle nutrients, so how are you going to do it and in what form? And all I do is what's the most profitable way of doing that, and the one we're focused on is using grazing.
I would like to add in there that it's about understanding what you're taking and how you replace those things when you have an export off your farm. And I think that being really conscious and mindful of making sure that your inputs are actually benefiting your system, as Graham highlighted, you know, there's very destructive ways to put additives on your farm and there's very constructive ways. And I think really understanding the way nutrients are available to plants, and plants is the basis, whether you're a cereal grower or a meat producer, I mean, it all comes back to your plant growth. And understanding actually how that cycling of nutrients works and enhancing that cycling. And if you can actually be returning product onto your farm, whether it be compost or whether it be enhancing the biology or whether it's with ensuring that the litter layer is decomposed in a constructive way so that it's not heated up too much and that your ground cover stays there being effective, then there's no decrease in your productivity, and you're not actually mining anything, but it's understanding how to put those inputs back to your farm, and whichever way you source them, it's making sure that you've got a conscious decision that you're not doing any harm. I guess that's my medical background, that, you know, do no harm philosophy, and I extend that to the land, that, you know, we have to be really conscious to not do harm, and it's about having a knowledge bank that actually allows us to make conscious decisions that are beneficial.
Thank you, Lynn. It's about time that we'd like to close this. So I'd like to thank the people who've been online, and also I'd like to thank the farmers who are going to be listening to this, because we just do know the farmers are the most important people in our society, the most important people in the world. So Lynn and Graham, would you like to sum up what's your key messages for the farmers, or just like to sum up, Graham, and maybe give the contact details of yourself?
My message is that, my thing is always do a trial, see whether it fits your business, and keep reading and exploring. The easiest way to get me is on the email. Usually I travel sort of nearly full time, and it's graham.hand@bigpond.com, and it's graeme.hand@bigpond.com. Thanks, Hugo.
Thanks, Graham. Now, Lynn, Helen's got a question to ask you about the Soil Learning Centre. What's your feeling about that?
I have found the Soil Learning Centre to be an extremely valuable resource. I've been able to access some experts in field, and they've been very accessible, and the feedback has been very direct, and pinpoint to the questions I've asked. And the opportunity to learn from that environment is huge, so I would encourage anybody, if they've got access to the internet, to have a look at the Soil Learning Centre. I can't encourage them enough, and I guess that's probably my premise for it. The way I conduct business is that it's about enhancing knowledge, and I can only encourage people to gain a greater understanding, actually reclaim that knowledge base so that you're in control of your decision making. You know, it doesn't have to be somebody else's decision, and any avenue that you can find to enhance your knowledge, and don't be scared of it. It's not that it's difficult to understand, but it's not overly time consuming either. You know, it's not something you have to dedicate hours a day to. But you'll find that once you get a little bit of an understanding, more things will fall into place and the jigsaw puzzle picture will come into focus really quickly. And the Soil Learning Centre is one of those fabulous resources that's available there. If anybody wishes to contact me, again, email is probably the easiest way, and that's through thegreencocky@gmail.com. all lowercase.
Lynn, thank you very, very much for that. Graham, thank you very much. I'm going to wind up now. Have either of you got a departing word or two?
No, I'm good. Thanks, Hugo.
What about you, Lynn?
I would just say be bold and step out into a new area that maybe you're not so comfortable in, and you'll find that the shoes are actually quite well fitted.
Fantastic. Now, I'd like to thank all the people on who've been online. I'd like to thank you, Graham, for coming online. We've been actually privileged to have you and Lynn online, and I hope farmers appreciate the privilege that they have of listening to this CD, because it's actually, believe it or not, it's groundbreaking. Although, it's, as you both said, it's not new information. It's groundbreaking in that we've had this tremendous disconnect in the agricultural world, and we've got to re-establish that connection between many factors. So on that note, I'd like to say goodbye from Hugo Disler from Farming Secrets. Graham and Lynn?
Yes. Did that go well?
Yep. All right. I'm going to wind up now, and I'm going to get off there. Thank you very, very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.